football on Off the Ball.
Halftime show, what was it, 27 minutes long?
Yeah.
That's shocking. That's absolutely shocking. The players should be the main focus here. I mean, it's a game of football we've all come to see. We haven't come to see the Muppets.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The News Round is brought to you by Viagra Connect 50 milligram film coated tablets.
Contains sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150 milligram tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation.
You're welcome along to Monday Night's Off the Ball. It's Mick McCarthy here with you until 10 o'clock tonight. Owen is back in a couple of days, believe it or not, but you've got me for the next two nights anyway. We have a lot to talk about tonight, none more so than the very sad death. The news came true today, the sad death of the legendary Liverpool player, Hamburg player, Newcastle manager, England manager, even Kevin Keegan, who died today at the age of 75. We're going to hear from one of his former teammates. We'll hear from him himself when he was on the show a couple of years ago now. Maybe it was maybe 6 years ago at this stage when he was on the show with John Giles. And we'll relive the memory of one of the great football figures and seemingly anyway, one of the real nice guys of sport in this part of the world. So really sad day there. Also, lots more to talk about. Like, it was this insanely busy weekend, insanely packed weekend of sport. We talked about it in advance, and so often when we do, it turns out to be just that little bit disappointing. We had a hurling final where Limerick were dominant on the pitch and on the scoreboard. Pat Ryan and James O'Connor will be on after 8 o'clock to talk about that. We had a World Cup final where Spain were dominant on the pitch, if not quite on the scoreboard, until extra time. And so much to talk about from both teams in that game. Marcelo Mora Iorajo will join us after 9 o'clock to discuss what was frankly a bizarre performance by Argentina last night, both during the game and post-match. New Zealand 40, Ireland 21 means Ireland's wait for a win at Eden Park goes on, as is the case for so many countries. Fiona Hayes will be on Monday Night Rugby to discuss the positives and negatives of Ireland's inaugural Nations Championship campaign, or the first half of it anyway. You can get in touch with the show, WhatsApp 0879 180 180, or you can get us across social media. Arthur O'Dea and Stephen Doyle are with me for tonight's News Round. How are you doing, gentlemen?
All in good form, Mick. Well, I can't speak for Arthur, but
I'd say Arthur's in pretty good form.
You talk down the weekend sport there. It kind of just depends on your perspective.
No, well, the excitement and the drama of it all, I suppose. In terms of results, you certainly got what you wanted anyway. Yesterday afternoon, Limerick 6 All-Ireland in 8 years.
Yeah. But I must ask you, Steve, how you deal with it all, you know, when you're
9 years,
racking them up like this.
9 years.
Just more fuel for the fire.
Isn't a dark day for Leinster hurling, must be said.
Dark day for Leinster. For the rest of Ireland.
Well, what about Connacht? Would a psychologist have a go at the fact that since 1989, Connacht teams in football and hurling have played in 28 All-Ireland finals and they've won 3?
Shapers.
That's a gross overrepresentation for a province with 5 counties.
I'd agree, but why did
one
they keep losing the finals?
Well, it probably suggested a few different things. I think that's a good historical thing for Galway, isn't it? Like, you go back all that time when they used to just have one game, when they got parachuted into the semi-finals. So
that
I think
would have
it's
been 90 and 93, yeah. Not after that, though.
In general. I presume it's a long-running thing, like, but
I'm sure it is, yeah. I know, I would say that wasn't the reason Galway lost at the weekend.
No.
It was just a slightly disappointing, like, between both games, I suppose, if you add into it. You take in the golf, and I do want to actually stop on the golf for a second, because that didn't lack any drama towards the end, but I suppose it lacked some of the names that would make us kind of, you know, tune in and maybe like say, I'll go back over and see what's happening in the golf during the hurling final. It didn't have that type of leaderboard for us. And then we had a game that was just, I have to say, it was only 5 points, but it felt over at half time. It felt like Limerick were just on a completely different level. And then you had the World Cup final, which was never over and was tense, but it was bloody hard to watch.
Yeah, like I was talking, like during the hurling yesterday, I texted a couple of friends because, look, I'd be always more Gaelic football than hurling, as much as I do love watching hurling and stuff. But I texted a couple of hurling mates who And I think sometimes when you're not as like kind of close to it and kind of sitting there poring over analysis all week, sometimes you can get a really good helicopter view of the game almost. And I was kind of saying, look, the one thing that stands out here is the short puck outs from Galway, trying to play it from back to front throughout the through the lines, as they say in to use a football soccer parlance, whatever you want to call it, and it just wasn't working for them. They were, and then what's the other option? Then you go along, and they couldn't go along because of that bloody monstrous half back line that Limerick have. So there was just, it just felt like Galway literally could not do anything to take on that Limerick team. Now I'm sure, if you got someone like Paul Kinnerk in that Galway backroom team, he might have been able to come up with something. But just from me looking at the game yesterday, there was just, it seemed like no way. And then, of course, young Rabbit, the new up-and-coming star for Galway, I think that guy is going to be brilliant. That point he scored from the right side in the first half, wasn't it? Yep. He got away a couple of, from a couple of markers. And
after winning three frees already.
Just an incredible point. But it just seemed every time he got possession, he was like flattened by two or three Limerick lads around him. And
yeah,
it just felt like they were being suffocated throughout the game.
There's a text in here saying a lot, something very similar from Patrick. I thought that Galway were showing up tactically. The full forward and half forward lines were pointless. And if the Dubs proved anything last year, it's that if you want to beat Limerick, you put their full back line under pressure, and Galway never did that. We were talking about this earlier, Arthur, and you had a decent perspective low in the Hogan stand, weren't you? Like, it's like
Cusack, yeah,
Cusack stand. Sorry, they didn't forever about, like, I think it could be a bit too simple about the kind of one man in. I don't think that wasn't meant to be in there with no support against three men. They were trying to win possession, break free of the Limerick press, and then have runners like Neary, for example, as he did so well against Cork, burst in and join Rabbit up front and kind of attack the Limerick full back line. They just never got a chance to. I don't think they got a chance to do it. Neary broke through maybe and scored like an absolutely unbelievable point in the second half where he was challenged about nine times. He had to get a miracle score to kind of get into the game at all. After, you know, they were 10 points down at the time. But they just never got a chance to do it because Limerick, they could not get out of defence. They were getting caught in possession constantly. Limerick just had, and you mentioned Paul Kinnerk, like, what a coach he must be, because they had every single thing figured out. It was a masterclass from Limerick's forwards and midfield in particular in how they defended yesterday.
Yeah, I was unrelenting. But it was also striking, obviously, because Rabbit was occupying kind of a sole role there. Like, it was interesting how many times, like, Sean Finn or whoever was getting the ball from Quaid just with acres of room in front of him. Which kind of inevitably pushes everything back, which even means that when you do get it and come back up, there's just, you have to run the whole pitch back up again, and it just becomes exhausting. So I'm not really sure. I mean, I know they're getting, their whole thing is getting dissected yesterday and today, like, but it didn't, I don't know. I don't know what Galway could have done yesterday.
Yeah.
Like, it was all these great teams, I suppose, have their peak performances. And I was looking at the numbers earlier, actually, and I was through the six finals, and I think you were talking about it from a Clare point of view, and I think Limerick's average winning margin in All-Ireland finals has been just over 8 points.
Yeah,
so like that's from six finals, like there's two close ones and four kind of, if not blowouts, fairly conclusive wins. So there's just something to that. There's something to, as you're saying, having, be it Kinnerk or be it whatever the condition that the camp is in, whatever it is, that there's just, you have to be, you can't really catch them.
It's a good point. The feeling after most of the Limerick finals, the second Kilkenny one, I think in particular, certainly the Waterford and Cork ones on sort of either side of COVID, the feeling, Steve-O, was, God almighty, this team is untouchable. There's nobody can stop them. And it is a feeling that kind of only came after the finals. You think back to the Munster final, those years, anything, even the semi-finals, they weren't imperious. And if you, given what's happened in the last 2 years and the fact that they, you know, they haven't won it and they've been gone, for them to come back into a final and kind of peak on that final day again, it just, like, again, there's just something so, so right about the system in Limerick, like.
Yeah, definitely. I think as well, you can't, and we'll hear from John Coyley in the news round, I don't think you can underestimate the absolute pain and frustration and anger with themselves even that they felt over the last 2 years.
Yeah.
Because the way Coyley responds to one of the... Actually, Tommy Rooney put the question to him. We'll hear about it later. But it's just... You can really sense how much are rankled with them, the way they performed over those last 2 years, and that they went into that match yesterday going, that's not going to happen again today. This is... We're going out there and we're going to make sure that all 15 players plus subs give it their all.
Yeah.
And they absolutely did that yesterday.
And they all played their role to perfection as well. Yeah. We'll come back to the hurling in a few minutes. Before we get to the soccer, football, whatever we want to call it. I don't know why I said soccer there. It was weird. I want to talk about Ryan Fox, okay? So Ryan Fox, I don't know if anybody was watching this. It was in the in-between time. I'd imagine more people were in between the two games. But, you know, it was an underwhelming enough open. But Cameron Young had this amazing day, 64. He's in the clubhouse for an hour and a half. Ryan Fox is struggling around a little bit. Great birdie on 16, puts him level. You're thinking, can he birdie one of the last two holes? Well, 17's a par five. He'll probably do that. He doesn't. He pars it. It was one of the... His shots on 18 was one of the best ways I've ever seen somebody win a major championship. He waited around. There was a slow group in front of him. So he was hanging around. He stood in the tee for ages. And this is, by the way, the 18th at Birkdale's, one of the hardest holes in, like, you know, the open circuit, as they call it. Certainly to get a birdie on 18 on a Sunday. He rips it down the middle with no delay whatsoever. He's just like, you're kind of waiting for, oh, here we go, here's Fox's shot, and suddenly the ball's gone. And it's just like, he just skirts a bunker, it's a beautiful shot. He gets up, similar delay up in the fairway, stitches a 8-iron to about 8 feet under the hole. Like, you're talking perfection. Again, goes up, the player he's playing with, his name escapes me for a second now, he misses his putt, he taps in the other thing. Again, you're kind of getting ready, here's Fox's putt to win the Open, and before you kind of even are fully in, he's hit it, he's holed it, and he's won it, to a kind of a muted sort of New Zealand-y response, let's face it. But but Ryan Fox, people will know that his father is Grant Fox, who, All Black legend, let's face it, he was like the key number 10, he was the 1987 World Cup winning guy. He was a sort of linchpin of All Black rugby for years and years. So not a nobody by any means. His son is now a major golf champion. His grandfather, on his mother's side, was a former New Zealand Test cricket captain. That is not only one of the best sporting CVs for a family of all time, it's, I would say, the most diverse at that level. For it to be in three different sports and from coming from both sides of the family. Have we got a better example?
How not to be, I'm not discrediting, obviously, but I guess New Zealand, have they ever been a Test cricket powerhouse?
Yeah, they're I think that's unfair now. They're not, maybe not a powerhouse, but to be the New Zealand Test cricket captain, even back in the 70s, I would say you would have to be a fairly decent world-level cricket player.
I'll take your word for it.
I suppose you did. Phil Neville, Gary Neville, and their sister, England international netball player.
Yeah. And I think high-level cricket in that family as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we'll take that.
Well, Phil Neville could have been a Test cricketer, wasn't it?
Okay.
Yeah, I think he could have been a Test cricketer, but went for football.
087-9-180-180, if you can find a better sporting family than the Foxes / whatever his mother's maiden's name is, Wallace's. Listen, we'll get back to the World Cup final in a few minutes, and we'll get back to the hurling as well, for sure. But obviously, I mentioned at the top of the show, really, really sad news today, the announcement of the death of legendary player, manager, Kevin Keegan, at the age of 75. We're going to talk to one of his former teammates in just a second, but I just want to play you a little clip here. He joined Nathan Murphy and John Giles back in 2020. It was a celebration of John Giles' 80th birthday. And here's what Gilesy had to say about Keegan.
I'd have the highest respect for Kevin. In my opinion, Kevin Keegan transformed Liverpool when he came. Was it from Shrewsbury, Kevin?
Scunthorpe,
right? Liverpool went from 66 to 73 without winning a trophy. And Kevin Keegan was responsible for the transformation of Liverpool at that particular period. And I had a clash with him at Wembley, as we know. But I have the highest respect for Kevin Keegan. What he did for Liverpool, there's no doubt, Liverpool had gone a few seasons without winning a trophy. And Kevin Keegan transformed Liverpool. I've no doubt about that. And people think I mightn't like Kevin because we had a little bit of a clash at Wembley. A little bit of a clash.
Just a little bit. It was only a minor skirmish.
What did you do to him, Kevin? Because we don't understand, because John Giles is the gentleman. John Giles wouldn't react like that. What did you do?
Yeah, the Johnny Giles that you know was a gentleman, but the Johnny Giles that played for Leeds was like his twin brother. When he went on a football pitch, it was another Johnny Giles. He was lovely off the pitch.
One of the most famous incidents of Kevin Keegan's career, the Charity Shield that time. Steve, I have some details on this sad news.
Yeah, the former England manager and captain Kevin Keegan died aged 75. The double Ballon d'Or winner announced last month he'd been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. He enjoyed a playing career with Scunthorpe, Liverpool, Hamburg, Southampton and Newcastle and scored 21 goals in 63 international appearances. A trailblazer in the club game in the 70s, he scored 100 goals in 323 appearances for Liverpool, winning 3 league titles, an FA Cup, European Cup and 2 UEFA Cups. He left Anfield for a then British transfer record fee of £500,000 to join Hamburg in 1977. And it was there he won those back-to-back Ballon d'Or awards in 78 and 79. He won a league title with the German side as well. Keegan then went on to management, taking charge of Newcastle, Fulham, Manchester City and England. His spell at Newcastle really was incredible, brought in to save them from relegation to the third tier of English football in February 1992. He did that and then went on to win the First Division the following season and then promotion to the Premier League. The Magpies finished third in the Premier League in their first season, qualifying for Europe, sixth then in the 94-95 season before that infamous 95-96 season when they led the table by 12 points in January before ending in second place behind Manchester United. His family said today that he was a much-loved husband, father and grandfather.
Absolutely, and a much-loved football figure as well. Phil Thompson, his former teammate at Liverpool, joins us on the line now. Phil, terrible news today.
Hiya, Mick. It was absolutely shocking news. Obviously, we all heard the news a little while ago, but for it to happen so quickly has just been absolutely devastating. It really caught me on the hop. I knew he wasn't well. He had conflicting stories that he was going to do an appearance somewhere. And it was just absolutely such sad, sad news. For Gene and all his family, they must be absolutely devastated.
Yeah. Phil, the one thing that comes across watching from afar over many, many years that Kevin Keegan been in our lives is what a just genuinely nice guy he was. And like he would seem like someone that would go out of his way, to maintain friendships, to not let people down, I would say, again, kind of looking from far away. Is that indicative of the Kevin Keegan you knew?
No, it is. And that was one of the great things about Kevin. Nobody had a bad word for Kev. You can go on and we always talk about the greats and this fellow was good and this fellow. But this Kevin Keegan had time for everybody. He would spend hours. He would go along to do something. And if he was supposed to finish at 10 o'clock, he'd still be there at midnight. He never refused a photograph. He never refused a signature. When we played for England, he was a superstar worldwide. We could be in Romania or something. There'd be scruffy kids standing at the front just wanting a scrap of paper be signed. He would sit on the front step of the bus and he would sign everything. So Ron Green would have to go, Kev, we really need to go. And he'd apologise to the kids in his way and say, look, I've got to go. But he wouldn't let anybody down. He was the most humble of people. And it was... He knew his limitations in life, which pushed him to greatness. But the other side is he knew, particularly with England manager's role, that he didn't have what it takes to take a team forward. And he was similar with Newcastle. And that was the greatness, the honesty that this guy had within the game. And yes, we'll all go, oh, yeah, everybody. But this fella was truly one of those guys, one of those greats.
Yeah. Do you know what? That last game in the old Wembley has come up a few times in conversation here in the office today, because I do think it was a little bit unique. I do think him kind of coming in that time and just saying, you know, I haven't done a good enough job here, I'm off, not worrying about, like, you know, what his reputation looked like or what his payoff was going to be or whatever it was. He was just kind of like, honest, I'm ready to move aside and let somebody else do it. There was something incredibly honest about all of that.
Well, it was honest and unique, and that's what Keegan was about. You know, I was there as obviously a younger lad, 3 years as junior at Liverpool, and he came in and it was honesty about everything that he did, his drive, his determination from that very first pre-season. And he just wanted it so much. I remember a game at Southport. I'm a young lad. Kevin's just joined. And we played at Southport. It was 0-0 at half-time. And nobody went against Ronnie Moran, who was our manager of the reserve team. And Kevin at half-time sat there in the dressing room and he went, we're never going to score playing like this. We're never going to score. And he went, oh, do you think you can do better, son? And he said, yeah, I can. And he said, OK, will you play up front? He scored 2 goals. And it was, he knew what he wanted. And it was a drive that took him to greatness. And I was listening to Johnny Giles there. And he was talking about him and Billy Bremner. They could have played for Argentina, them two. They were that bad. they were in cahoots against Kevin in 74. But listen, some of the things that he said there, we were in search of a hero. After our great 60s, my 60s, of Roger Hunt in St. John, we were in search of, in those early 70s, of a hero, of a superstar. And a long-haired lover came along and he just transformed the football club. He really did.
Yeah.
And it was him and Shankly. Shankly and Keegan, the both of them were in harmony. And, oh, Kevin was just, honestly, those early years, he could do anything.
Yeah. And was it from the work ethic and the mindset? Because, like, obviously he's played, like, he's with Scunthorpe for quite a while, and like he comes to Liverpool in 71 and kind of like quickly enough becomes like the big player of that team and, you know, the mainstay. But I mean, it obviously wasn't, he wasn't like someone that was scouted from a young age or anything like that.
He was just had these values which suited Liverpool. Liverpool suited Keegan. There's been quite a lot of players like that. But Kevin came in and was so single-minded of what he wanted. And he was just, he wanted to be a superstar, and the fans took to him straight away. His work rate was infectious.
Mm.
You talk about high press and things like that. Keegan was full of it. Him and Toshack were just quite incredible. Honestly, they were a pair of strikers who were just perfect match. Big man, small man.
Yeah.
Kevin could easily sort of play off Tosh, and it was just something which was just made in heaven, the pair of them.
Yeah, and I suppose that work rate and everything like that in the press is kind of what made him such a great player. What was like? Is there anything else that kind of stood out to him as a footballer, like be it with Liverpool England? Because obviously, other than like maybe 101 great goals videos, none of us will have seen him.
Oh, they were great. You know, Wembley. Scoring 2 goals at Wembley in 74 to beat Newcastle was something, and then going on to greatness with Newcastle. But it was what he did for England. You've got to imagine, Mick, this guy became a world superstar like George Best.
Mm.
This fellow was, at the time, played for Liverpool, but then went to Hamburg, got his pen, which was a massive, I think he copied mine, that was. But he was just this guy who stood out. And in 1982 in the World Cup in Spain, I think if Kevin had been fully fit, he only played the last 15 minutes of the second phase of the group stage. We played against Spain and West Germany and two not bad sides. And he only played the last 15 minutes against Spain. And if he had a chance, Trevor Brooken, who'd been injured, had a chance, they'd have been fit for that second stage. I do think we could have got further than that, but hey-ho, hasn't that been ever thus?
Absolutely. Before I let you go, just a couple more questions on Kevin's life. When he went into management, again, we kind of mentioned his time at England there, but again, it was his character. It's just, you think of the early days of the Premier League and all of the success that Manchester United had and Alex Ferguson being the central character of all that. Like, his greatest foil was Keegan. And again, not just for that one moment that we'll see over and over again in that interview, but what I do think that I saw some people say that, like, playing that is kind of disrespectful to him today, but I did think that did kind of sum him up in a way. He was someone who was kind of like, he playing the game on its merits. And when he saw somebody like Ferguson, maybe kind of like, you know, try to twist it or try to do it sort of differently, he genuinely was just so furious at the whole thing. But again, he was someone that you saw, like, I saw a clip recently of the two of them together at the, like, the opening ceremony of Euro 96 on ITV's coverage, and they were best pals again. Like, you know, he got over it pretty quickly, but it actually did sort of sum him up, didn't it?
But that was Kevin. You know what? That's what you have to understand. He had this love affair with Liverpool. He had this love affair with Newcastle and the Geordies. And he wears his heart on his sleeve. And he wanted to tell not just that TV, but he wanted to tell the world. There's no, you know, I'd love it. And it was a moment of absolutely pure television. And Kevin was there in the moment. He didn't care what it was about. He was just a love of Newcastle and how he was going to hopefully try and drive Newcastle to the title. And if it was with Alec, Kevin was like that. Kevin could absolutely rail against the world and then the next week be best mates with everybody. He had that wonderful nature about him. Of all the greats that I've been and sort of been around, Kevin was the nicest, most humble of every player that I've ever played with. And I tell everybody that. I'm not just saying it for you guys now.
Yeah.
It has been what has been mandated. People will know that.
The last thing then, Phil, is, like, he was one of football, maybe post, like, George Best, but he was almost the next one, wasn't he? He was like, there weren't too many kind of international superstars around the place in football in the 1970s. Kevin was definitely one, be it brute ads, his hair, everything like that. But I don't know, it was never someone that seemingly came across like a superstar.
No, he didn't. And that's why I say the humility of the guy was just amazing. He was the first guy that I ever knew had an agent. Mm. And we were shocked. Well, why do you need an agent? We just signed contracts with Liverpool, and then all of a sudden Kev had this agent. You know, you're driving a sort of Jaguar sports car. And you were, oh my goodness. Well, he had worked his way up. It didn't change him as a person, which was the great thing. But you just knew with Kev, as he went along with different stages of his life, he deserved everything that he got out of football and out of life after it. He was just incredible. But what a player. And it was timing of this long-haired guy, George Best, what he gave to the game, and he was completely out of the norm. And then, lo and behold, Kevin Keegan, Liverpool, long hair, and he was just sensational.
Mm. Listen, Phil Thompson, thanks so much for popping on this evening to pay tribute to your friend, Kevin Keegan. like, that was lovely stuff there, lads. Like, I mean, it's hard to kind of imagine, you know, Steve-O, I'm sure you do as well, Arthur, you remember it, but, like, for our people our age, Steve, he's like, Keegan was such a huge figure, wasn't he, growing up? Like, be it the Newcastle manager, but also he was the guy your dad kind of talked about, wasn't he? Like, from the previous generation, it was just always Liverpool fans, especially in your life, would always be Keegan, you know?
That's the thing, like, and do you know something? I went to have a look at the Ballon d'Or winners because, as I mentioned in the script, he won back-to-back Ballon d'Or, 78, 79. So you think he was the best footballer for two seasons. Like, you think about how high his level must have been at that time. And I was saying to you guys earlier in the studio, you know, obviously Messi and Ronaldo are at a ridiculous 8 and 5, respectively, Ballon d'Or awards. Then you go under that and you look at the only other players that have won more than one Ballon d'Or aside from Keegan. Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, Alfredo Di Stefano, Ronaldo, the original Ronaldo, Franz Beckenbauer, Marco van Basten, Johan Cruyff and Michel Platini. Like, what an array of footballers you have there. And to think that Kevin Keegan is up with those players. I only wish that he had been maybe playing a bit more within our lifetimes to see exactly how good he was. But that kind of gives you a bit of perspective, I think.
100%. Okay, we'll leave it there. We will come back and do the rest of the news round, including more talk on the hurling and the All-Ireland final after this. Right, you're welcome back to the rest of Monday's news round, and we really haven't got into something. Obviously, we were talking to Phil Thompson before the break about the very sad news about Kevin Keegan. A couple of texts in here. We were talking about Ryan Fox and whether or not his family history is as good as anything in terms of its success and diversity. Someone says the Haaland family. This is D. Henry 91 on YouTube says the Haaland family pretty decent on both sides.
Mm.
Agreed. But, you know, that's a mother and a father create a superstar, you know, both sports people. I think you need a third generation. You need a third generation or something, or like, you know, a third sport.
Yeah. Yep. John Egan.
I'm not dismissing it.
John Egan, I know. John Egan's soccer, his dad, Gaelic football, his mother won a League of Ireland title as a footballer. And also, she won a football All-Ireland as well, I think.
Too much football.
But yeah, there's a lot of, yeah.
Well, I suppose, yeah, Brian Barry Murphy played, you know, he's probably ended up going to be a Premier League manager, and he obviously played professionally in England for a long time, and his father was both a footballer and a hurler. So does that count as three different sports?
And the grandfather, Dinny Barry Murphy?
Oh, is there?
His grandfather, granduncle? Also, okay. I think, yeah.
Lowry's our close. Lowry's not far off as well.
Lowry's
Lowry and Shane Lowry couldn't have been more diverse in their achievements, I suppose. Yeah, so I'll give you that one for sure, yeah. Again, who's the cricket captain granddad, though? You know?
Yeah.
Okay, one more text then as well. We have, I've lost it. Okay, Steve-O, what are we starting with here?
Yeah, well, look, we go to the All-Ireland Senior Hurling Champions, Limerick, who are being hosted by the County Board and Limerick City Council at Perry Square in the city tonight after their latest success. The Senior and Minor All-Ireland Hurling Champions will be there for the celebrations, which were due to get underway from around 5 o'clock. Just saw some photographs recently there on social media. Looks like there's a massive crowd down there tonight. Yesterday's win in the Senior Final against Galway at Croke Park secured their sixth All-Ireland Senior title since 2018. Cathal O'Neill hit 140. As the Munster champions cruised to a 129-118 victory over Galway in the decider. John Kiley has been at the helm for all of those title wins, and our man Tommy Rooney spoke to him after the victory.
You know, you reference the 6-3 meetings after the defeat to Dublin, all the sessions you've had since November 15th. What are those minutes like in the aftermath of achieving what you've done today?
It's just great satisfaction, in fairness, and just a shared sense of joy, like God Almighty. You know, I was a part of 94, 96, and the hurt that leaves never leaves you. You know, it scars you. Anyone that was involved will tell you that those days are never go away. So just sheer joy. And in particular, you want to see the team achieve their potential. And I felt the last 2 years, we left a bit of ourselves after us. We just didn't produce the quality in those key moments to get across the line. And look, we were up against great opposition. You know, Galway today, I mentioned them earlier. They are an incredible team, and they will come again. But look at Clare, Cork, you know, Tipperary and Waterford brought great challenges to us in their own right, in the Munster Championship as well. So, you know, it is always difficult. There's no day that you're going to get anything easy. That might have shown a margin of difference between the two teams, but it was one that we earned by sheer application and quality in what we did.
It's a really interesting point at the end, isn't it? We're talking about kind of like how Galway played or whatever, but is that because Limerick, you know, put the work in both in management and in the players? What about Kylie, Arthur? 6 All-Irelands for a Limerick manager. Like, and I think that you know, should be stressed as well. This is unique footing for Limerick. This isn't Kilkenny, Tipperary or Cork. Maybe it is now, but it wasn't before John Kiley. You'll hear a lot about Caroline Curd. You'll hear a lot about Paul Kinnerk. You'll probably hear a lot about JP McManus. But I don't know if it all doesn't fall apart if John Kiley isn't there.
No, and he was very quick to deflect anything kind of from himself.
And his future, yeah.
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 Like he was very kind of effusive in his praise of Kinnark and everyone else afterwards. But it's hard to know. I feel this year we've got to see more of him.
I think so too. I was thinking that during that clip, yeah.
He's definitely opened up, and I don't know, is that a conscious thing or is it something that changed?
Because Tommy is doing such a good job.
Maybe he's brought out that side of him. But look, we never know. Like and you know what was interesting? I know a lot of people made a lot out of it. But obviously I was there yesterday when Keane Lynch was giving his speech, and there's this big rousing applause when Caroline Curd's names rang out. And you understand it, right? But you're kind of, it's like, my initial kind of thing, I was like, well, that's a response to the narrative, right? So the narrative is that she's really important, and she may be really, she clearly has
an
impact.
And she wasn't there the 2 years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But nobody knows what she does. So all these things are kind of reinforced. So they win and everything. And everyone gives a big, massive cheer because that's the narrative. And I guess we'll know in time with Kylie where he has almost, I think of all the great teams, it's not that he's underrated, but he's almost gone the most under the radar of any sort of these great managers. Mm. Like Gavin was obviously kind of inscrutable, but like there was this kind of genius applied to that inscrutability, which is clear in the results, whatever. And Cody was arguably, it was him or Shefflin of that Kilkenny era. Whereas with Kylie, I don't know what we know of him. I don't, you know what I mean? In that weird kind of way. It's very hard to piece together. He obviously has something, but we've never been shown what it is.
I think you're right, but I think there's an art, there's something that makes me think he could be the best manager of them all. And I mean that as manager. And I don't mean he's not a hurling coach, and I don't mean he doesn't like know the game, but I think what he's managing there and how he's managed to keep that team together for as long as they have, performing at the level that they are, bringing in the right people. So, like, I'm sure Caroline Curd being back this year after being gone for 2 years matters massively. But I'm sure even she would say herself, if we were to ever interview her. We did interview her a long time ago, actually, but she used to be on panels and stuff, but she's, yeah, big time now, you know. But I'm sure if Caroline was to say it, she would say, I'm one aspect of something that needs to go into a team. And you will hear, Seamus Flanagan has mentioned a good few times on the show, Caroline would say this, Caroline would say that. And it's really, really important. But she is one aspect of a load of things that they had to do well to make this work. And one of them was bringing in the best at every single one. So it's not that she's the best of that thing that you need in your management team. Paul Kinnark is the best of that thing that you need in your management team. And I'm sure they have a lot more less famous people that are the best people that are in their management team. And that's all down to John Kiely and how he runs things. He basically manages it like a operation, like a business, you know.
Well, so, like, did he not?
It's really impressive.
Like, did he not give a bit of insight in a way with that particular answer? Because he did speak about the pain and the hurt of when he was there in the 90s. And then he speaks similarly of the last 2 years for the team that he's now managing. And we also know that he did sit down, was it 63 something meetings?
Yeah.
With people involved.
High number.
Now, that does give you a bit of an insight, because he wanted to make sure that every single player got to express their own views on what happened the last 2 years, plus he then maybe contributing to where he felt things were going. So I think that kind of does give us an insight. And that also says that here is an absolutely incredible manager as well as a hurling manager.
Quite possibly. I think more so than anything that he'll be defined by is that humility, which I think is kind of seems to be the cornerstone of everything that he does.
Yep.
It's but by the same token, like, he's obviously has, he must have an immense presence as well. Like, there has to be a thing where, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He must.
You can see that even.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Where it's just, and that's obviously probably something that, unlike, say, with Lowen and Clare, where it's probably like by deeds done, they're like, and everything else. But like, he's obviously had to shape that over time as well. And maybe it's so vital that he had so many of those guys at those formative years at underage that it kind of carried over.
Yeah, I think so.
But the gene up the crowds in the semi-final was another.
Yeah, let's come back to that.
Snapshot.
Yeah. Find that an interest.
Yeah.
There's so much to talk about in limericks. Say they're like, the other thing then is the record in the final,
which is what is it? Is that 13 finals now and 12-1? I think over the
it was like 19 or something, wasn't it?
Maybe it's higher. So obviously they've won 6 out of 6 in All Ireland finals.
Yeah,
but you know, between Munsters and everything like that, the only and league finals, the only thing they've lost is a penalty shootout.
Is it 19 now? 18-1.
Yes,
and the one that they lost was in a penalty shootout.
A draw. Yeah,
so technically a draw.
In fairness, like, you know, so like that's unbelievable. I mentioned earlier about like we come to the end of Limerick seasons and talk about how imperious they are and how far ahead of everyone, and it's all based on the final when you actually think about it. And that's because whatever that is, that their ability to peak on the biggest day again speaks hugely to a management team led by John Kiely. So I really do think we have to start getting into our heads here that John Kiely is there not just because of All Ireland's won, but because of all the evidence along with it, that with the Codys and the Gavins and the Mickos and the Heffos.
And to your point initially that you opened up on, is it's what's so fascinating, and I suppose will be studied over time, is the fact that to do that, they've inverted every sort of historical tendency about Limerick hurling. Like, because when you talk about even 94 and 96.
We talked about this yesterday, didn't we?
Yeah.
Like, as in, this is a big deal.
Like 94 and 96 are like, they're kind of like, they're jokes, but it almost becomes like defining.
Yeah.
It's like, well, that's what Limerick do. It's like you might have the odd breakthrough, but they slip up on the big day.
We're going into a week of talking about this with Mayo again. Like,
and
Andy Moran's biggest task will be to overcome both Kerry and history.
Yeah.
And it matters massively, because when the chips are down and when they had to go, and Limerick did not fall over the line, but they had the work, they had the work done for the first 68 minutes, is all I'll say, in 2018, because it was a hard thing to kind of get past in the end when Galway were coming at them. But then once they did it, but not only that, which I think is a really good point about like losing finals and everything like that, it's also a case of like what this Limerick team have done. And this goes to beyond just Kiely, this is everything around them and these players, is you've had, Limerick have been a team, say, like on that second tier in hurling, Tipperary, you know, would straddle both, but Tipperary there with Kilkenny and Cork, right? Limerick on the next tier on their own. What Galway and Clare did in the 80s and 90s respectively was get themselves into a position where they had so much success that they put themselves on that thing where they're always going to be relevant. I would have called that the Limerick tier.
Yep.
That's the only movement we've had. Offaly have kind of gone and come back, but they had it as well, right? But they Offaly would have put themselves again onto that Limerick tier, right? That second tier, always relevant. You never know. They might win one every now and then. And that's an incredible place to be for Galway and Clare, by the way. What Limerick have done, they're the first team to do this in 90 years, maybe 100 years.
100 odd years.
They have gone to the top level. Mm. They are there. If Limerick don't win a match for 5 years, we'll think of them as a hurling superpower.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And I think that's now unbreakable. I think they are going to be up there with Cork, Kilkenny and Tip for as long as more as there is a game. You know, and maybe that's an insane statement,
no,
but certainly in terms of how we think of them. And I think that's an unbelievable achievement that hasn't happened in this sport. You know,
it is perpetuating. Yeah. Mm. It's the remarkable times to be living through, in all seriousness. And it's like, but it's funny how you could almost say a little bit. Obviously, Mayo have had a very big last decade, but you could almost say, imagine in 10 years' time if Mayo have won 6 All Irelands.
Yeah,
it's the equivalent kind of thing you're talking about. It's like, what if you'd said that in 2016, 2017? Oh yeah, in a decade's time, Limerick will have become whatever they've become. It's like it's unfathomable. So he deserves an enormous amount of credit.
Okay, we'll come back to the hurling after 8 o'clock. We've got Jamesy and Pat Ryan, so looking forward to that chat. We might dig into that kind of historical significance at some point as well as digging into the game. What else have we got, Steve-O?
Yeah, look, Dublin manager Paul Casey admitting the better team won, as his Dublin side were beaten by Kerry in the Women's All-Ireland Senior Football Championship semi-finals. They will go on to face Kerry. The Kingdom defeated the title holders 217-19 at Semple Stadium. Galway, did I not say Galway?
You said
I have
Kerry,
Galway here in my script. Kerry beaten Dublin to set up a final with Galway. The Kingdom defeated the title holders 217-19 at Semple Stadium on Saturday, and in form Shifra O'Shea scoring 1-8 to help set up that showdown with the tribeswomen, who had beaten Armagh earlier in the day. That final is at Croke Park on Sunday, August 2nd.
This was awe-inspiring performance from Kerry. Like, I mean, they absolutely, like, it was over after 5 minutes, and that's like, this isn't playing like a team who've, like, you know, faltered into the semi-final. This is like a multi All-Ireland winning team in Dublin, and two early goals. I think it was 2-5 to 2 points after just
10 minutes and it was over already after this. So this is a Kerry team that have been looking like this all year, but you don't know it's definitely going to happen until you see them play in All-Ireland semi-final against Dublin and realise they're just on a completely different plane than everybody else. So not saying they have to do it again against Galway, but I wouldn't be backing against them.
Absolutely. Argentina, meanwhile, are facing an investigation by FIFA following altercations involving members of their team and backroom staff. Spain were crowned champions thanks to that winning goal scored by Ferran Torres in the 106th minute in New Jersey. The team finished scoreless after 90 minutes and Argentina midfielder Enzo Fernandez was sent off for a second booking in added time at the end of the second half. Torres came off the bench to score the winner and seal a second World Cup win for Spain, who are of course winners in South Africa 16 years ago. After the game, Argentina defender Nahuel Molina appeared to punch Rodri on the arm or stomach. Leandro Paredes also got involved, taking on several Spain players and appearing to throw punches, while video footage appeared to show Argentina assistant coach Daniel Ayala striking Spain midfielder Dani Olmo. Eventually, the Spain skipper Rodri got to lift the iconic gold trophy alongside the dynamic duo Donald Trump and Gianni Infantino. The Spain fullback Marc Cucurella praised his skipper's performances throughout the tournament.
For us, it's very important. I think sometimes it's not about just scoring or assisting. I think he controls everything. He organizes the team. He decides when we press. He decides when we attack. And for us, it's very important. Every time we are under pressure, he gives us a chance to give him the ball. He never loses the ball. And I think he deserves this trophy because he played an amazing tournament. Yeah, it's unbelievable. I think since the first day we arrived here, we try to play our football, our style. I think we start a little bit maybe sloppy the first games, but step by step we are improving, we are playing, and I think these last two games we play an amazing football. We dominate both games, we create a lot of chances, we control the game, we concede nothing. So I think we play an amazing football, we deserve this trophy.
Now, meanwhile, Wayne Rooney wasn't the only man making silly forfeits at the tournament. I don't know if you saw Rooney rowing down the Mersey after,
it that got to the second round?
It was Norway.
He
said they wouldn't get to the quarterfinals, yeah. Anyway, Cucurella said earlier this week that he would tattoo coach Luis De La Fuente's face on his body if Spain lifted the trophy. The quotes from De La Fuente at his press conference last night: "I am too old for tattoos, but my players are men of their word, and I know they will stick to their word."
It's like nobody asked you about getting a tattoo.
He then says, "They made a mistake, and they will stick to it. I am not that ugly."
The oldest World Cup winning manager.
Is he?
Did I see that right? Or was it first or something like?
But what a job.
Oh, I'm not too sure.
I heard something about him being the elder.
Older than Lippi?
Look, I'm only saying what I heard. Maybe I didn't hear it right.
I don't know. I'm just thinking.
He looks well.
Lippi looked about 90 since he was like 32, though. So, like, I don't actually know what age he was in 06. Right, anyway. We'll talk more about Argentina with Marcella after 9 o'clock. So, they're our focus in the women's chat. So, that means we have to give the focus to the real story of the World Cup in this little chat. So what did you think of the halftime show and Donald Trump? By the way, the Donald Trump thing was 4 years ago, we sat here, 3.5 years ago, we sat here like fuming at what happened with the presentation ceremony to Messi. I didn't find this as offensive. I found this a lot funnier. Trump is such a pathetic figure.
It's like
he's such a pathetic figure, and he didn't know where to be going. He didn't want to get away. Rodri was not going to lift that bloody cup until Trump moved over to the side. He just wasn't going to do it.
He'd remind you of Lloyd Bridges in those airplane movies, you know, the spoof films or Hot Shots. You know, expect him to get the old handkerchief out and start kind of cleaning his ears from left to right, right through. And it's just, the whole thing was just so infuriating that the halftime show was like 27 minutes, a complete nonsense.
Halftime is 27 minutes.
Like, it's fine for, this is fine for American football. I'm not trying to denigrate American football or NFL, whatever the case may be. It's such a stop-start game, whereas football, it's a momentum game. Like, the hydration breaks. Like, hopefully it's the last we'll ever see those bloody things. And the halftime, like, leaving players sitting around for 27 minutes when their bodies are up to a certain time. Like, just the whole thing was a complete nonsense. The music was rubbish. Like, the like, I...
sorry,
I can't believe Ronaldo.
If they got the Beatles back together, two of them from the dead, it would have still been a disgrace. Like, yeah, this is a joke.
And the music aside, like Ronaldo and Ronaldinho completely embarrassing themselves driving this Madonna taxi. Like, what? I saw somebody earlier. It was like, they look like that photograph you see of people when they get off a funfair ride. You know, a still photograph, the two lads sitting at the front of the roller coaster. It was just, the whole thing was a complete nonsense. And I just...
Why did Ronaldo not know how to stand? Why was his arms and his legs so far apart? He looked so... I've never seen a more awkward looking human being.
And Robbie Williams looked like Paulie Walnuts out at the Sopranos. Yeah. Like, it was just... Yeah.
But like, all joking aside, I don't like halftime shows or whatever. When the Super Bowl's on, that's all everybody's talking about. I'm usually like, you know, getting a cup of tea or something or whatever. So that's irrelevant, I think. It's more that there was one. And, you know... I know it sounds twee or whatever, but like there is a law of the actual game of football that says the halftime can't be more than 50 minutes. And FIFA just deciding, or Infantino probably single-handedly, let's face it, just deciding that that doesn't matter anymore. But we don't need a special decree. We don't need a special, you know, dispensation. We don't need to do anything because we just control the game and you can all go and F off. Basically, because you don't matter, and people who football around the world does not matter. What I say goes, and look, we get 11 billion at the end of the day, and sure, isn't that great? And so we can, you know, I'm not going to say what he can do with that 11 billion, but he is going to be elected unopposed in the next FIFA election for his presidency. So there we go. But like, I just hear, like, I thought the RT panel were brilliant on this at halftime, and I don't say that too often, like, but I thought they were really, really good. There's been loads of good discussion about this. But where is it leading? He's completely omnipotent. Mm. He's sitting up there, like, you know, having a belly laugh. Giving Donald Trump the World Cup in the middle of the match so Trump could touch it.
Jeez.
The game got so bad at one stage, by the way, that Trump was talking to Melania. That's how bad things got.
Hey.
Second time they showed him, he was having a chat with the wife. Doesn't happen too often, does it? The fourth wife.
Oh, man. Jesus.
Anyway, any other thoughts?
Look, there's nothing. Spain nothing,
were good, weren't
nothing
they?
New to
Hard
be said.
To watch. But,
Spain,
you know.
Spain and terrible World Cup finals. More power to them. Roll on 2030.
Yep.
Whatever that
is. Portugal, Morocco, Uruguay.
And Argentina. Totally normal
smash
World Cup.
Yeah,
Jumping back, Italian 90, lads.
Back to basics.
Yeah. It was hard work getting to Corsica and Sardinia. Like, you know, that was it.
We've got a Euros in Dublin. That's to look forward to.
A little bit.
And of course, the Women's World Cup in Brazil next summer, which is... Well, it'd be nice to be down the Copacabana with, you know, supporting the girls in green.
Have we got one or two more very quick stories?
Yeah, look, I'll give you the draws for the UEFA Conference League. A couple of glamour ties potentially for the Dublin clubs. Ajax or Vojvodina could face Shelburne if they defeat Cagliari in the second qualifying round. Bohemians can knock out, if they can knock out Balkany, they'll face either Besiktas. Could Mo Salah be playing for them? Let's see. Or Midtjylland. And then a win for Derry City against Rijeka in the second round would see them go on to play either Stjarnan or Ilves. In the Champions League, Shamrock Rovers could meet familiar opponents in Slovenian champion Celje for a second year running. They have to overcome Aramat Armenia in the second round of the Champions League qualifiers to face either Celje or Ignatia of Albania. And what else have we got then? Munster Rugby, an independent governance review of Munster Rugby now underway. That follows the cancelled appointment of Roger Randall earlier this year after historic rape allegations surfaced when he was signed as the province's attack coach. He has always denied the allegations. Munster says it does not want to attribute blame with the review, and it says it aims to strengthen governance, accountability and decision making.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see how it goes. Still to come in the show tonight, we have Marcela Mora Iarajo about Argentina. We will have Fiona Hayes, Monday Night Rugby, looking back on Ireland's defeat in Auckland on Saturday morning. And in the next hour, we're going to speak to James O'Connor and to Pat Ryan
about the All-Ireland Hurling Final and Limerick's sixth All-Ireland. The news round is brought to you by Viagra Connect 50 milligram film coated tablets. Contains sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150 milligram tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation. Okay, we will go and take a little break.
The news round is brought to you by Viagra Connect 50 milligram film coated tablets. Contains sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150 milligram tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation.